I'm a little bit of the odd person out in a many-body physics workshop because my lab is focused a little bit less on quantum simulations and many-body physics and dynamics than a lot of the people at this workshop. What I do is I'm a trapped ion experimentalist. So, sorry, the photo in the background here is the only illusion that you're going to have that I'm actually an experimentalist. It's a photo of our ion trap. And the rest of the talk is going to be completely theoretical and design work that we've been doing in my group. So we're interested in studying hardware architectures to make trapped ion machines more useful, kind of more powerful than what they already are. And I'm going to give you a very brief overview of two different projects that I have going on. One is making use of multiple different states within a trapped ion to encode a multi-level qubit as opposed to a two-level qubit. Those are redundant phrases, by the way. So a qubit is just a multi-level qubit, but it's easier for you to hear me if I, you know, tag it as multi-level. And as Rajabul promised, I'll also give you a very brief overview of the facility that we're trying to build to make quantum computing available to, well, all of you. So when you think about encoding quantum information in qubits, there's been a decent amount of theoretical work on this, and you can imagine that there are some plausible advantages to it. Obviously, the Hilbert space of a given number of ions is going to be larger if you have more different states per ion. And there have been people who have gone through and checked, you know, can you do algorithms more efficiently using that increased Hilbert space dimension? It looks like the answer is yes. Can you improve error correcting codes? Probably yes. That's not really the focus of what we're doing, but we did want to kind of review that literature before we started getting into the very difficult problem of how do you do this in the lab. So the question we've set ourselves for the last year and a half is how we implement useful qubit operations in the lab. So first of all, as we know, when you want to perform quantum computations, you need several very basic building blocks. You need to prepare some initial state. You need to be able to measure states. You need to be able to do single qubit and two qubit gates. And we have ideas for how to do that, which I've presented last time. But now we wanted to look at whether the error rates are going to be prohibitively awful. And defining what is too much error is kind of a big problem. We don't really know how to answer that. It's going to have to do with fault tolerance thresholds, which I know very little about. It's going to have to do with engineering away control noise. It's going to have to do with the fundamental atomic physics limitations. So we set ourselves a simpler problem. May I borrow this pointer? We wanted to focus on the atomic physics limitations. And we set ourselves a somewhat arbitrary goal of saying, if we have, if we account for all the error sources we know we're going to have, will we be able to achieve a high fidelity, thank you, operation? And we set ourselves the goal of achieving a 99% fidelity because that's kind of close to some fault tolerance thresholds for qubits. And before I present those numbers, I do want to give you some caveats. So we calculate a very specific thing here. We look at specific experimental protocols. So I know how we will do all of these things in the lab, down to what laser polarizations do we need, how do we need to modulate our lasers, details of that nature. So it is realistic in that sense. And then what we did is we said, given that protocol, we're going to put some upper bounds on the fundamental limitations. So the errors are going to be smaller than what we calculated. We just wanted to get a rough estimate. But when we do these experiments in the lab, we do expect that the fidelities we see at first are going to be worse because, you know, always there's more error sources than what you wanted. But most of the additional noise is going to be things that we can eventually engineer out. On the other hand, what we're presenting is also not something I would consider a fundamental limitation because, as I mentioned, we're looking at upper bounds, and we haven't done an exhaustive search of maybe there are cleverer ways to do this. So in that sense, it's sort of a wishy-washy set of numbers, right? It's not quite what we want to, what we think we'll see in the lab. It's not a fundamental limitation. It's just an indicator that we're probably going to be able to do just fine. Okay, so the problem with measuring qudits is you need to extract more than one bit of information. Very briefly, the way that we intend to do this is, let's imagine that I have three qudit levels in the ground state of an atom, and I'm going to use an atom that has some metastable set of states, and it also has some state up here that scatters lots and lots of light when I turn on the appropriate laser. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to stick two of my states up here on a shelf, out of the way. They're not talking to the detection laser. Then I turn on a laser. I look, if I see fluorescence, then I know I was in the state zero. And then if I don't see fluorescence, I have to start bringing back my states one by one and check, did I have fluorescence from the state one, and so on. And two, and three, and four, and five, however many you like. So the punchline, when we go through and we estimate all of the error sources, we don't know how to necessarily improve or put upper bounds on them, as I said, is that we do think we can achieve 99% fidelity on the measurements for our three-level, five-level, or even seven-level qudits. And so that part seems like it's going to be okay. The single qudit gates, the way that we choose to do them, is there's a few different ways you could take a single qudit unitary and break it down into a bunch of different operations. And the way that we're going to do this is we're going to sequentially apply pulses on these different frequency resolved transitions. So essentially what we're doing is we're saying, let's say you want to do a Fourier transform or some kind of single qudit gate. We're going to break that down into the equivalent of like a sigma x rotation on this lowest frequency transition, followed by a sigma y on the highest frequency transition, and so on and so forth. So it's basically like the single qubit operations that you already know. And for these as well, we can achieve quite low fidelities in principle, or I'm sorry, quite low errors. You hope the fidelities are pretty high. So these are not likely to be our biggest limiting factor. And the entangling gates are going to be a generalization of the technique that Rajabul alluded to earlier. So basically, we just use the fact that the ions have some Coulomb interaction, and then we push them around with lasers in a way that depends on their qudit state. And we've come up with a way to create a unitary gate that looks like this thing. So it's a sum of the S sub X operator. Let's say I have a three-level qudit. This would be a spin one SX operator. So that's the gate that I'm trying to make. And for this one, we've only figured out how to do high fidelity operations in the lab for D equals 3. For D equals 5, we think we could probably push this number a little bit higher, except for there's this minor little problem that we don't know exactly how we would make lasers that do the thing we want them to do, so we're not pushing too hard on that right now. And I was supposed to skip over that in the interests of time. So basically, what we have achieved is we've convinced ourselves that we can do 99% fidelity operations for three-level qudits. This is work that we're pretty much done with that we'll be putting on the archive hopefully any week now. And so the next step on that is obviously going to be starting to experimentally test these things. And with that, I'm going to switch gears completely. I think I have 2 or 3 minutes left, yeah? Okay, so as Rajabul mentioned, we're also starting up a collaboration where we're building a quantum processor, which is meant to be basically a service facility that people who are doing all kinds of research can submit jobs to our quantum processor and get results back, kind of like IBM Quantum Experience, but we're really focused much more on the low-level controls that we need for certain specific types of research. So we're going to be building a quantum computer based on an architecture that's used at Maryland and several other universities, which we know can achieve 10 qubit quantum processing type of scales. And what we've been doing is we've put a lot of effort into going around and talking to all the different types of people who might want to use this thing. So Rajabal might want to use it to do quantum simulations. We want to support that. Ray LaFlamme might want to do some quantum error correction. We want to support that as well, and so on and so forth. So we've had, there's actually more different types of researchers we've spoken to, but this gives you a flavor that we want to be supporting trapped ion physics, gate optimization and different kinds of algorithms and so on. So that's kind of a large challenge. So how are we going to do that? Basically, our approach is to focus on how we control the machine and go dive down into the deep, low-level controls much more so than what you would get on, for example, IBM Quantum Experience. So if you break out the different kinds of layers that you might need to think in terms of these abstractions, you're all familiar with kind of quantum circuits, but if you dig down into the hardware, there's a whole lot of stuff going on, right? There's going to be some timing where we have to precisely turn on and off laser pulses. We're going to have to turn that somehow into these natural gates, which are going to be like sigma X rotations and specific types of entangling gates. We can put those together, of course, to make Hadamard gates and CNOT gates and the types of things you see in quantum information textbooks, and then put those together into quantum circuits and so on. But really, this very low layer, which disappeared on me, is the thing that we most want to focus on. So I don't really have time to go through the details of the architecture in great detail, but I do want to flag for you because we are still figuring out we're just now finalizing how people will interact with this thing, and it is going to be different from how you would interact with an IBM machine or the Google machine because we need this very low-level control. So some of the things that you're going to need to think about if you want to use this machine include, at first, we are going to need you to specify very specific timings. So you need to be able to tell me, I want this gate to happen at 100 nanoseconds or whatever. You also are going to be limited in the sense that, let me find my other slide that I used for this. The way that you're going to run an algorithm is you describe a quantum program, and it's going to, we'll have some libraries that you can say, I don't care about ion trap details, just give me a state that I know how to work with. And you'll be able to say, okay, now give me a control NOT gate or give me the specific laser pulse, whatever. You're going to hand that to us and we're going to run it and you're going to download measurement results, but you're not going to be able to do any other computation on our machine. So if you want to do a hybrid quantum classical algorithm, then you need to submit a job, get a result, do your own gradient descent or whatever else you want to do, and submit another job. So that's possibly a limitation, and I want to bring that up in case anybody here, since I know some of you do think about this, in case anybody here would like to tell me about whether that is a limitation for them. And with that, I think I've run way over my time, or at least come very close to. So let me acknowledge my team. And oh, come on. There we go. Acknowledge my team.